Good Sunday morning and welcome to another edition of the Gaelic Hour here on Chin 97.9 FM with Austin Cameron, and we're also out there on the internet on chinradio.com, or you can catch us on thegaelichour.ca. My email address is austin@thegaelichour.ca. In today's programme we're going to talk about a book that has recently been published called Labourers on the Rideau Canal, and we'll be talking to Bill Wiley, Dr. Catherine McKenna and Dr. Bruce Willis. The Church of the Ladies are out at Centrepoint on Saturday night. A pair of tickets given away through the web today, and a pair of tickets given away tomorrow night on the music program. You have to go on the web for that, so get on there, log on, enter your name, answer the question, and you could be the lucky one. Some of the other things that are going on here in the city: on tonight at 8 p.m. the Lieutenant of Inishmore continues at the Gladstone John P. Kelly's production, and tomorrow night at 6 to 8 p.m. the Irish language and dance classes are resumed at Blessed Sacrament, 194 Fourth Avenue, and there's also a session down at the Irish Village at Roisin Doves, and I want to express my thanks to the ongoing support that I receive from the Irish Village group of companies. Without their help, this program would not be on the air, and also to the Monterey Inn Resort. Of course, on Wednesday, there is Irish Set and Ceilidh Dancing, and that's under the auspices of Coltis, and that's out at the Marconi Centre at 1026 Baseline Road. And when I look down on Friday night at 9 p.m, the Ottawa Gaels get underway with their indoor Gaelic football, and that is at the Algonquin Dome. And Dermot Ginnane is the contact there at 819-771-6888. Cherish the Ladies, of course, are at Centrepoint on Saturday evening, 8 p.m. And again, a pair of tickets to go give away today, but you have to go to the website, thegaelichour.ca, and you'll see there, click on the prizes button, and you can enter. And then we'll have a pair tomorrow also. Next Sunday, the Gaels get underway with their youth training, and that will be at the Oz Dome, and that's for kids 6 to 15 years of age. And of course, planning for the Ottawa Irish Festival is well underway, and we have Roisin coming into town on the 16th of March at Library and Archives Canada, and tickets are now on sale at Ticketweb or the Ottawa Folklore Centre at 29.50 for Roisin. Roisin are a tremendous group out of Quebec City that really have embraced Irish music. And there's also a fundraiser coming up at St. Bridget's on the 31st of the month, and that is to raise some funds for the parade. And Peter Rock is the contact person there. You can give Peter a call at 613-237-0665. And that's from 2 to 4 p.m. And the parade, of course, will be on March 14th. But we're going to move right along and hear all about Labourers on the Rideau Canal. The publication Labourers on the Rideau Canal was launched a few weeks ago, and one of the contributors is Bill Wiley, and Bill works with Parks Canada in the National Historic Site Directorate and has been with Parks for a long time and has a good handle on the local aspect of the historic sites, particularly the Rideau Canal. Bill, welcome to the Gaelic Hour. The publication and your contribution to the publication, do you want to give us a little background on what was about, how you got involved, and then the actual paper itself, what that covers in the book?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my involvement was related to the fact that I was Parks Canada's Rideau Canal historian for a couple of years, and at the time a lot of research had been done on the managers officials behind the building of the Rideau, and particularly on Colonel John Bai, who was responsible for the design of the Rideau Canal, but not too much had been done on the thousands of workers who had taken part in the building of the Rideau. And so one of my tasks was to try and put together a picture of these people, of the lives they led on the Rideau, and of what they contributed. And that was really the purpose of the paper. The paper was really trying to emphasize two things. On the one hand, the enormity of the achievement of the construction of the Rideau, and on the other, the great human cost that it took. The Rideau was built almost entirely by hand, without the aid of mechanization. Between the years of 1826 and 32, when it was constructed, There were probably between 4,000 and 6,000 workers on the canal every year, which was made it, along with other canal construction projects at the time, made them some of the largest public works projects in the history of North America to that time. Of the 4,000 to 6,000, there were probably about 1,000 men who were skilled artisans, such as blacksmiths and carpenters and masons, but the rest were as the so-called, in quotation marks, common laborers, the pick man and the axe man who chopped down the trees and the shovel man who helped to excavate the canal locks. They really did an amazing amount of work and created an amazing achievement drawn to the plans of Colonel By, but it came at tremendous cost to them. It was really a miserable existence on the Rideau during those years. It was a remote area with not very much settlement, bush, lakes, rock, mosquito-infested swamps. I should have mentioned by now, actually, that of the 4,000 to 6,000, the majority of these people were recent Irish immigrants. In fact, that was true of most canal construction in North America at the time. After the end of the Napoleonic Wars, and from about 1815 to the 1840s, there was a continuous flow of Irish immigration to North America of people who were trying to get away from deteriorating economic conditions at home, and who came to North America, in many cases penniless, looking for work to get enough capital together to start a farm or a shop or whatever. In this area, they arrived in the cities of Montreal and Quebec City looking for work, and they were faced with a labor market where French Canadians were also flocking to the cities to try and find work to supplement their income from their farms. And as a result, there was a surplus of labor during most of the period, including during the construction of the Rideau, that resulted in very poor wages for these people. It's been estimated that the wage rates probably were just enough to take care of a single man, but many of these people had arrived with families. So that's the first strike they had against them, because they were not going to get much of a nest egg from this in order to go on with their lives later. The second was simply the backbreaking nature of the work. The felling of trees, the construction of lock channels, the construction of dams and lock walls and so on, all by hand, as I've mentioned. And one of the problems was that it was back-breaking work and dangerous work. There were quite a few workers, we don't have exact statistics, who were killed during the construction of the Rideau by falling rock or falling trees, and a particular difficulty with the use of gunpowder that was used to quarry out the stone for the construction of lock walls. And in many cases, this gunpowder exploded prematurely or with greater force than was intended, and quite a few workers lost their lives as a result. They were also working in extreme climatic conditions. Most of the work went on during the summer, when they would find themselves in intense heat and in swampy areas, as I mentioned before, mosquito-laden swampy areas. And even some of the work went on also in the wintertime, where there was extreme cold, for which Irish immigrants were not really prepared. They had no experience of this kind of thing in the past, and many of them did not have clothing that was suitable for the situation. The other thing was that the living conditions of these people were also very poor. At most lock stations along the canal, they had to make do with whatever shanties they could put up themselves. There were barracks and or log houses put up at a couple of lock stations where it was hoped that that workers could be attracted to these lock stations by doing that if they were having trouble getting workers at particular stations. But for the most part, these people were on their own. The other third strike, if you want, is the incidence of disease. It was a real problem during the construction of the canal, and in particular, a particular kind of fever called swamp fever or ague was very common, particularly in the later summer of 1828, 29, and 30, when it stopped work on the southern half of the canal towards Kingston. And medical historians have since concluded that this fever was actually a form of malaria picked up from the mosquitoes in the swamps. The symptoms were such that a person would be debilitated for several months at a time. In the late 1820s, in the southern end of the canal, over 50% of the workforce was infected with this, which made it very difficult to get workers at those sites during those periods. And not only were, while about over 50% were infected, there was about 4% of those, we estimate, who actually died, which, although it wasn't a large proportion of the whole, it was enough to account for hundreds of workers. So this was really a preliminary to the emergence of a working class in Canada. It's the first time when there were large numbers of workers working at wage labor, in particular at a few workstations. In other words, where there would be large groups together, and it was they also got a bit of a tip off as to what working conditions would be like later in the century in large factories, where they would basically be paid only what the employer felt was necessary to pay them, and in conditions which were frequently very poor conditions.
If I can ask you, when you said there were 4,000 to 6,000 workers working along the canal in a year, the construction of the canal itself, was that then being carried out along most of the route simultaneously, or was it that there was a high concentration of labor in segments and the segment was completed and on to the next segment?
No, in fact, the route was constructed pretty much simultaneously. There were 23 lock stations along the route, and so there were workers spread out along that route, and in some cases at the larger lock stations there may have been something like 500 workers. So at the smaller ones you might only get fewer than 100, I guess.
Right. And then you said, like, most of the construction work was done, and is understandable, was work done during the better weather period. If you have 4,000 to 6,000 people who are getting a subsistence level income, and they, excuse me, that they're only maybe getting 6 to 8 months' work, what, or do we know what these people did, or how this managed in the off season when they weren't getting work?
Well, they were in big trouble in the off season. In fact, this was a characteristic of British North America at the time. In general, that during the winters, the common, so-called common labor, the person without a special skill, was frequently unemployed and in destitute situation, suffering from the cold, looking for firewood and this kind of thing. In fact, there are recordings of what these people looked like when they came back from the lock stations, readying themselves for the winter. And in fact, many of them were already in very poor conditions. And in many cases, they had left their families at either end of the canal, at the urban centers, Kingston in the south, or Bytown, which became later Ottawa, in the north. And the families had been living in these very crude shanties, shanty towns, and then they all had to buckle down for the winter, basically.
You can't but get a sense of the horrendous scenario it must be, particularly when we look around at the moment and the snow we have and the chaos it causes us in what is modern society, where we have heating and everything else, that it's unimaginable in many ways what people must have had to endure.
Yeah, certainly. It was a different world, a much more brutal, a cruder world, especially for people without much means. And I mean, even for the families that managed to settle in farms and so on, it was a real challenge to survive. And for people who didn't even have that place to go to and didn't really have a house to live in except what they could cobble together themselves, it would have been extremely difficult and a real shock probably. Because these people really, I don't think, knew what to expect when they came from Ireland and from Britain. They would be getting away from a difficult situation, but they had no idea of the challenges ahead.
Bill, I'm very glad that you took the time to talk to me. The book is entitled Labourers on the Rideau Canal, and I'm sure it's available around town. Bill Wiley, Catherine McKenna, and Bruce Elliott are the contributors. And we will be talking to Catherine after we come back after this piece of music. Bill Wiley, many thanks for coming and talking to me on the Gaelic Hour.
Thanks, Austin. I enjoyed it.
They came to a country across the sea that needed the work to feed the families. So the Irish left their homeland far away. Only came to a world all water and trees. In the summer they'd sweat and in the winter they'd freeze. But they had hard cold stone to move. They were digging a Rideau Canal all the way to Kingston town. Many a poor young Irish man lay buried in the ground. They were digging a Rideau Canal and it seemed just like a dream to carve a waterway to the world for the coming century. Oh, their hammers rang and the fires roared as he forged their way along the rocky shores. He battled fever and sickness all the way. And at night their music just filled the skies as he sang about home and family ties. But he lived and died to moonstone. They were digging the Rideau Canal all the way to Kingston town. Many a poor young Irishman lay buried in the ground. They were digging the Rideau Canal and it seemed just like a dream to carve a waterway to the world for the coming century. Now when I behold with shining eyes everything they did, I feel my spirits rise. I know that their heart is here with me. Oh, in the mist in the morning and the rain at night, I hear them on the lake when the wind's just right, knowing they did not labor here in vain. They were digging a Rideau Canal all the way to Kingston town. And many a poor young Irishman lay buried in the ground. We're digging the Rideau Canal and it seemed just like a dream to carve a waterway to the world for the coming century.
Hello there, this is Daniel O'Donnell here and you're listening to the Gaelic Hour on Chin 97.9 FM. Keep the dial where it is.
That was Robin Averill and his Rideau Canal song. You can go on the website and win a pair of tickets for Cherish the Ladies at Centrepoint on Saturday night, and I'll announce the winner for those tomorrow night on the music programme, and I'll also have another pair to give away at that show. We'll be back with you after these messages. Welcome back to the Gaelic Hour here on Chin 97.9 FM with Austin Camerton. We're going to continue our conversations relating to the book Labourers on the Rideau Canal. And we're now going to talk with Dr. Catherine McKenna, who edited and contributed to the book.
And Dr. Kent McKenna is actually from Ottawa, but is a professor in the Department of History and also in the Department of Women's Studies at the University of Western Ontario. Welcome to the Gaelic Hour.
Oh, I'm very happy to be here.
And this wonderful work, Libres on the Rideau, how did you get involved in? Can you give us a little background?
Well, it goes back a long way. This piece that I contributed to the book, I originally worked on when I was a graduate student more than 20 years ago. And it was a little piece on one section of the Rideau Canal, which is Newborough. Newborough is a very small place. About 300 people live there. And today you'd never know that it was the site of such a huge construction project so long ago. But it was a very, very difficult site on the Rideau Canal. So Parks Canada was interested in learning more about what happened at that site. So I did a summer project for them where I wrote about the Isthmus, which was the name of the lock at Newborough. And I wrote a paper, and it was published in their microfiche report series, and I doubt very many people read it after that. Kevin Dooley, who's a member of the Ottawa Irish community, was very interested in Rideau Canal history, and particularly the Irish on the Rideau Canal, and there were many Irish at the site that I researched. He found my paper and thought it should be published, and talked to Frank Tierney of Borealis Press. And after a number of conversations, it ended up that I was to edit it's a small volume. There are three papers in it. My paper, which is very specific on the Isthmus site, and Bill Wiley's paper, which is a general overview of the work on the Rideau Canal. And both of us emphasize the labor that's involved in the building of the canal. And then we added Bruce Elliott's very interesting genealogical resource on tracing your Rideau Canal ancestors, because many people in the area are descended from those who worked on the canal and are very interested in finding more about their heritage. And this, of course, is all instigated by the declaration of the Rideau Canal as a World Heritage Site, which is a wonderful recognition of the work that these men did on the canal.
So when you did the study back a number of years ago, was there anything in that really surprised you to start with, that when you started to dig into history relative to the history, the Newborough and the conditions and everything else surrounding the time, how would you describe your reaction to what you were finding?
I was quite amazed by it, to tell you the truth, because like many people growing up in Eastern Ontario, I was very familiar with the canal and visited as a recreational site, and there are many beautiful sites along the Rideau Canal, and it has been well maintained since Parks Canada has got involved in it. So I thought of it as a lovely waterway and a recreational area, and Newborough is a very sleepy little village and a nice place where people visit in the summer. And when I read the stories of what went on during the construction, the history of it, the kind of strife that went on, the difficulty of the laboring conditions, the amount of human suffering that was involved in the building of the canal. There was tremendous illness at the site. There was enormous construction difficulties. Lots of deaths occurred, and I had no idea that there was so much difficulty involved in it. It was a really tough piece of work. Colonel Bice, who was the builder of the canal, his career was ruined over it. There were tremendous cost overruns. But the product is a really an important one and well worth being a World Heritage Site. So I think one of the things that surprised me back then was finding out how much malaria there was in Upper Canada in that time period. And it was rife, and it was from mosquitoes that had bit soldiers who'd served in the tropics. And so it was widespread in Upper Canada at this time.
I'm going to throw you a curveball.
Okay.
Given that you're with the Department of Women's Studies, did you come across anything relative to family life? Because if we know that there's documentation out there about the workers and their health and their wages and everything else, it would be reasonable to assume most of the workers were men.
Yes, but pretty well all the workers were men.
So it would be reasonable then to say, so somewhere in the background there were families.
Yes, there were.
Did you find anything on that, or were you looking for anything on that?
When I went back to look at this material for the second time, because, of course, I wanted to revise what I had done when I was a graduate student more than 20 years ago, I have done a lot of women's history since that time, and I've done a lot of contracts for Parks Canada, and some of them I've done early military history this time period, and found a lot of evidence that at military sites there were really large, significant quantities of wives and children living in the barracks and in forts in Upper Canada. So I looked for this material when I went back again, and I'm quite sure that there were women and children living at the site that I studied. I know there were some records of them being there and of them being ill at the same time that the workers were. I think conditions of living were very tough for them as well. And there are, for some of the immigrant families, there are firsthand accounts of the really miserable conditions that they lived in along the side of the canal. So we know that it was hard work, that families did live at those sites. Sometimes the families would stay behind in a larger town like Kingston. We have some first-person accounts of that. And there are medical inspection reports from the military that talk about how much the women and children suffered from the illnesses that were present along the length of the canal, and often worse than the men. We have very little, though, that would give us first-hand accounts, and this is part of the problem of trying to do this kind of history of working class people, that we're heavily reliant on people talking about them rather than them talking about themselves or leaving a written record. So what we know about the women is really fragmentary. We know they're there, but we don't know much more from their point of view what their lives were like. And we have a little bit of records about some of the widows that from military men who died on the site, and because they had to be provisioned and were often sent back to England. So we know a little bit about some of their faiths. The information isn't is small but suggestive.
You mentioned that Bruce Elliott covered the genealogy aspect, but coming back to oftentimes history source tends to be churches, because if you can go and you can find birth certificates or marriage certificates, it tells you stuff. Was the facility there, or were people able to practice religion, and were there churches along the route of the canal that would have allowed that around Newborough?
No, there wouldn't have been, because we're talking about a situation where the men were really working in a wilderness setting, and so they wouldn't be able to just go off and attend a church on Sunday. It wouldn't be really possible for them, because there weren't good roads at this time, and it would be a long way to get to a major urban center. The closest place might be maybe Smiths Falls or Kingston, talking about Newborough, and that's a long distance to go to a church service. So although we do know something about that many of the men were, you know, whether they were Catholic or they were Protestant, or there's some indications that they're religious conflicts on the length of the canal between Catholics and Protestants, although I don't know if that was very widespread, but there are a couple of instances of that. But I don't think that they probably would have had access. Now, maybe there might have been an itinerant preacher or priest who might have gone along the length of the canal, but if there were, I haven't heard of them.
And it would be unlikely that they would have been documenting in the same fashion as in a church.
No, they wouldn't be keeping records in the same way, and that's really, I think, very poignant about the history of these canal laborers. Because although, for example, in Newborough, there is a cemetery where many of the Royal Engineers, the sappers and miners that were with Colonel By, are buried, and you know we know that those men are buried there. But there are also workers who are buried at many sites along the canal, and in unmarked graves, and we'll never know who they were.
And that point, actually, I do know, to mark some of that and the loss of life, there are a few. There's a Celtic cross in Ottawa, and there's one in Kingston, and I think, is there one somewhere in between?
Yes. Well, there are, I think, two or three Celtic crosses along the site of the canal, and I've seen the one in Kingston, and a picture of the one from Ottawa, and they're lovely markers, and I think those who erected them in honor of the workers are to be commended, because they should be remembered, because they did a very a wonderful job on the canal and at great cost.
When you worked on your paper 20 years ago, I'm sure you never would have envisioned that the Rideau Canal would have been dedicated and designated a World Heritage Site back then. You must have been very happy and pleased and proud when that happened.
Very much so. And that, I think, is also why I'm very pleased to have been given the opportunity to edit this book, because I think, although we started it during the year of the commemoration, that's what inspired the book. And it's been finished, you know, a year and a half later, or just a bit later than the actual commemoration. I still think it's a tribute to those canal workers. I think we tend to look at the Rideau Canal, the magnificence of the, just the sheer feat of building it in the wilderness and what an engineering feat it is. And it is an engineering feat. But it's, I think, really important to remember the history of the laborers, who I think, I would argue, are probably the first real Canadian proletariat,
mm-hmm.
those who are working on the Rideau Canal.
Dr. McKenna, I've taken enough of your time. I'm really happy that you took the time to talk to me. And it was wonderful to see your contribution in the book. And the book, of course, is Laborers on the Rideau Canal, and it's on Borealis Press, and is available around here in Ottawa. Dr. McKenna, thanks a million for talking to me on the Gaelic Hour.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I enjoyed it very much.
Gaelic Hour, Chin 97.9 FM.
We've been talking about the publication Laborers on the Rideau Canal, and one of the contributors is Dr. Bruce Elliott, and his contribution is entitled Tracing Your Rideau Canal Ancestors, Records of Laborers, Squatters, and Tenants on the Rideau Canal. Dr. Bruce Elliott is a professor of history at Carleton University. Bruce, welcome to the Gaelic Hour.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And fascinating title.
It's a fascinating subject, I think.
Yeah, well, it puts it all in context when you say laborers, squatters, and tenants. Tell us more.
Well, there were people who worked on the canal, both during the construction. There were people who worked on the canal following the construction. There were other people who settled along its banks and lived there and had small holdings, small farms often, and combined working that land with working on the canal, working out for nearby farmers, working in the timber camps and so forth. And often they were there without the authorization of the government officials who ran the canal at in that period. And there were also people who were tenants and sometimes also purchasers of lands in the canal reserve and also in the Bytown town site, which was initially the property of the Ordnance Department.
So one of the things I see you notice mentioned here is that oral tradition in many of the Eastern Ontario families maintains that an ancestor worked on the construction of the canal. So if it was oral tradition, when or at what point in time would some of this have started to have been documented, would you think?
Well, the documentation does date from the time. The difficulty with proving that someone worked on the canal construction is that the canal construction was done by private contractors. And these contractors hired their own labor, and they kept their own records. And so we're very fortunate that in some instances these records survive. But the records of most of the contractors do not.
And when you say the private contractors, the type of records that you're looking at could have been things like attendance or that they turned up for work or pay information, a variety of stuff like that?
Yeah, largely pay lists, that's right, yes. It would give the person's name and it would give the amount that they were paid and the dates that they were paid for. They tend not to say what they were actually doing. You can sometimes deduce that from the rate of pay, whether they were doing laboring work or whether they were working as a stonemason or something like that. But the two sets of records of contractors that do exist are the records of Philemon Wright of Hull, who had some contracts for the St. Louis Dam, for example, at Dow's Lake. And the other one is John Redpath of Montreal, who had a number of contracts for Jones Falls, for example. And his records are at the McCord Museum in Montreal. Philemon Wright's are at Library and Archives Canada in Ottawa.
And medical records also, or medical returns?
Yeah, yeah. The medical returns are only for about the first year of the works. Dr. A.J. Christie in Bytown was a Scottish immigrant who became the editor of the Bytown Gazette newspaper, actually, for a while. He became medical officer for the Northern Works for about the first year. And his records are in a collection of family papers, again, at Library and Archives Canada. And the detail there is not bad. It gives you the name of the individual and the dates that he was seen to, and it gives you what the ailment was, and it's usually in Latin, but you can get that translated pretty easily. And if the person died, then it'll give the date they died, or if they went back to work, it gives the date that happened as well. But, you know, be warned, for everyone who was injured in an explosion of black powder or something like that, there was another one who was in there with a disease like syphilis or something.
And a lot of them would have been quite, either the injuries or the diseases would have been quite fatal, like a lot would have died?
I wouldn't say a lot. There were a lot overall died, but remember, this is one doctor for 1 year.
Okay.
Of the works, and certainly most of the people who were in his list were discharged back to work.
So, I know from the work that's been done and all the publicity that has gone, the canal has received in the last few years, the awareness of the tremendous price that was paid by workers in building the canal has been well documented. And, of course, my interest is the Irish focus on that. From the papers that you looked at, were you able to see that there was a strong Irish connection that has ultimately established itself in the locality?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. There are quite a number of names in some of the lists that are very familiar. And we tend to forget that not all the Irish who worked on the canal came here specifically to do that. Some of them did, but quite a number of them were already living in the area. And they had taken up farms in a number of cases. And this was a way of supplementing their income, a way of getting some cash in order to be able to feed their families while they waited to get those farms into production. You know, it was a bit of a trade-off. How do I spend my time? Do I spend it chopping down trees, or do I spend it making a little money doing some work on the canal? And quite a number of local people decided to take that latter option. So some of the people who have these oral traditions may well find some confirmation of them. People who have no family memories of this may be surprised as well. A lot of French Canadians are in these lists as well, particularly Philemon Wright's list. He preferred to hire French Canadians. He thought they were a little easier to deal with than the Irish sometimes. But
I'm not going to go there.
No, but that was his view. And so it's certainly not only Irish that worked in the canal, but certainly, as you say, vast numbers of them did. And it's not only just Irish Catholics. There are fairly decent numbers of Irish Protestants from the Ottawa area that are on some of these lists as well.
And I think that's an important comment to make, because the perception often out there is that the people that fled Ireland at various times from various famines, not just 1847, were really only Catholic, but the Protestant population in Ireland were suffering also. And certainly across the Atlantic.
Can I say something about the records of the tenants in Bytown?
Mm-hmm.
I think this is really interesting, because I know that as a researcher myself, for the longest time, I really didn't know where a lot of these records were. And I remember years ago, I think it was I asked someone from the from Parks Canada if they had any idea where the rent rolls and things for the Rideau Canal had come to rest. And he said, oh, yeah, they're in the Department of the Interior records. And I was just flabbergasted, because I thought, well, Department of the Interior, that's the department that looked after settlement records for Manitoba and for the prairies.
Right.
But, you know, after Confederation, it moved around from one department to another, and Interior ended up being the main federal department that was looking after lands. And so they through the what was called the Ordnance and Admiralty Lands Branch, then in with Department of the Interior. And so that's where a lot of these rent ledgers and correspondence files and so forth ended up. But this stuff is absolutely magnificent, because anyone who lived in Upper Town or Lower Town particularly in the first half of the 19th century, but also heading into the second half, there are not only the rent rolls that show you where they lived and how much they paid, and indeed whether they paid or how much they were in arrears, but there's also correspondence from them about their leases. There are reports of the bailiff that the ordnance department sent around every year to check up on people's properties. And he wasn't there just to eject people who hadn't paid their rents. He was actually reporting on improvements so that they could actually increase the rents. And so he would report if somebody had built a shed, or if they had a workshop in the back in the backyard, or if he'd built a new fence or put a new roof on, or if the place had burned down. He'd report that. And so there's really quite a lot of detail here about some very ordinary people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's time consuming to use, but what I've tried to do in the article is to set out where each of these volumes is and how to retrieve it and what kind of information is found in each one, so that you can have a good sense of the kind of information that that's there, and what are the most likely volumes maybe to try for the person you're interested in. So it's a source that's valuable not only for people tracing their families, but also for anyone who's interested in properties in that part of town. There are not a lot of buildings surviving from the first half of the 19th century in that part of town. But if you're interested in what was there before the buildings that are there now, there's really quite a magnificent amount of detail that can be recovered about the nature of tenancy and the nature of the buildings and so forth that were there. Some of the correspondence even has little watercolor sketch maps mm-hmm. that one of the ordnance officials drew in order to enlighten the officials on the subject matter of the correspondence. It's really quite amazing what is there.
So, in a nutshell, in many ways, your contribution is providing somebody a roadmap of where to go in order to find specific information.
Yeah, that was the aim. That was the aim. And I'm certainly not saying that I found everything that there is to see. There are some other records out there which I haven't had a look at yet and which I do know exist, and mm-hmm. I'm sure there are others that I've missed. But I think it's the first time anybody's really put together so much of this material into and described it in such detail.
Right.
And I'm hopeful that it will mean that more people will use this material and come to find valuable the stuff that's there.
Now, to switch gears slightly, because I think it connects, and that is, I know you're very involved, correct me if I'm wrong, but in some of the genealogical organizations that in one of them here in the city, from a research perspective, if someone is interested in starting out on a path of research and stuff like this, there are places that they can go to meet up with others and start learning before heading in and into the libraries of library and archives or other places. What organizations would you recommend that somebody might go to, or where might they go if they want to just do a 101 and start out?
Well, there are several. The Ottawa branch of the Ontario Genealogical Society is here in Ottawa, and they have a website, and you can Google Ontario Genealogical Society, and there'll be a link through to the Ottawa branch. The other one is the British Isles Family History Society of Greater Ottawa. That's quite a mouthful, British Isles Family History Society, and there are a lot of members of that organization particularly are interested in their Irish roots and have considerable experience with it. But there's more and more material coming online all the time, too. And the Library and Archives Canada has a Canadian Genealogy Center website that has some very helpful suggestions for people who are getting started, and that's another avenue you can look at from home.
Right. I do have a link on my website over to the British Isles Family History Society Greater Ottawa, their site, because they have free lectures. I think it's on the second or third Saturday of the month?
Yeah, they meet Saturday morning each month.
Yes. I do have a link on the website. So
mm-hmm.
if you go on thegaeligar.ca, you can catch a link over to that. Bruce, I'm going to wrap up here and say, thank you very much indeed. It was a pleasure having you share your information. And the book is called Laborers on the Rideau Canal, and it's from Borealis Press. And it's out there in a variety of locations. And it's certainly a good roadmap, Bruce's section, a good roadmap on where to look and find lots more information. Bruce Elliott, thanks a million for coming on the Gaelic Hour.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to the Gaelic Hour here on Chin 97.9 FM with Austin Kemerton. Do come back tomorrow night and we will have a program of music for you. I hope you've enjoyed this morning's program. Don't forget there will be a pair of tickets available to be won if you go onto the website thegaelichour.ca and click on the button there that will bring you to enter for a pair of tickets for Cherish the Ladies at Centrepoint Theatre on Saturday night the 17th, and I'll be giving away a pair of tickets tomorrow night also. This program is brought to you in part by the generous contribution received from the Irish Village Group Companies and also the Monterey Inn Resort. A playlist is on the website, and this program will be available later on in the week also. So until tomorrow night, this is Austin Kemerton saying thank you for listening and have a wonderful Sunday Slongerfall.